Good. So welcome, everybody. Welcome, particularly welcome if it's your first time to the London Buddhist Centre. My name's Nyanav Archer, and over the next hour or so, just less than an hour, I'll be exploring, hopefully with your help, this subject of lies and truth, and what Buddhism might have to say about that. So I'll just kind of talk for a little bit, and then maybe I'll pause and then see if you've got any comments or questions. We won't be able to have a sort of group discussion. There isn't time, and there's too many of us. But you might have questions, and then I'll see if I can respond. Yep. So, this topic of lies... there's so much, in a way, to explore. I'm not quite sure what we will explore. But one of the things that I think it's worth starting with is that it's very, very difficult to tell the truth. Sangharakshita, my teacher, who is probably the most spiritually developed man that I've ever met, one of the things he's said is that it's very, very difficult to tell the truth, and that probably most of the time, most of us fall short of telling the truth. And what he means by the truth, he's got quite lofty kind of standards to what he means by the truth. So, for example, there's factual accuracy without exaggeration or minimization or any kind of gloss whatsoever. There's simple, flat, factual accuracy. At that level, even, if we think about how we communicate, it's probably quite difficult to tell the truth, isn't it? Completely, factually, accurately. It's not easy to do that. But also, in Buddhism particularly, it's not just about the factual accuracy. Our motivations, our intentions really matter. It really matters why we're saying what we're saying. What's our intention? So, for example, I could say something truthful and my intention could be to hurt. In which case, from a Buddhist perspective, that's not a very helpful act. It might have been better to remain silent than to say something that's going to be hurtful. Apparently the Buddha used to say that he would only speak the truth, but he would also take into account whether it was going to be helpful for the listener to hear what he had to say. And if it wasn't helpful, he'd remain silent. If it was helpful, he'd say it. He would also be aware of whether it was going to be pleasant or unpleasant to hear. But even if it was unpleasant, if it was helpful and true, he'd say it. Yeah. What he would perhaps also take account of is finding an appropriate time to say the truth, particularly if it was going to be unpleasant to hear. So there's all sorts of considerations that the Buddha, in one of the suttas, talks about relation to this matter of telling the truth. There is something also, as I say, about a psychological awareness of why we're speaking. What is it that we want to... What's our intention? What's our motive behind saying things? And I don't know about you, but I'm not always able to tell the truth. I don't think I am. It's something that I try and work with, but I'm not perfect. But I used to work in the corporate world, and in that corporate world... lying, or a degree of lying, was normal. It was just fine. In fact, it was strange if you didn't. And when I started practicing Buddhism, hi, come on in. When I started practicing Buddhism, I experimented in my job with telling the truth. And it led to all sorts of weird scenarios. I used to work in IT, and I was working on a multi-million pound development that was going way off the rails. And my boss kept telling his bosses and superiors that we were fine. It was all on track. It was all on track. It was going to be fine. And I was thinking, no, it isn't. It isn't. It isn't. And you know that it isn't. I know that it isn't. It's not going to be fine. And I ended up being a bit of a whistleblower. And I thought that people would listen. But actually, my boss's boss didn't want to know the truth. And her boss didn't want to know the truth. They all were complicit in this sort of lie that we were on track and that the money was going to be enough and we were going to deliver this project on time and in budget. They all wanted to believe that until it all went completely haywire. I mean, everything just collapsed. But then we all got promoted. because somehow it was nobody's fault. And we'd all done very well, and it was nobody's fault. And everybody got rewarded, and then everything just carries on. There was no consequence at all for anybody. Weird kind of sort of... Now, I don't know if that's completely typical, but that was just a sort of ordinary company, quite a good company that I was working for. And perhaps in certain industries, in certain parts of the world, it's normal to just tell lies. I was reading about this recent inquiry that has said that Putin was probably implicated in the killing of, in the murder of that Russian agent some years ago. Well, in Russia, you couldn't say that. You just couldn't say that. You would risk your life if you were going to even imply such a thing. Whether it's true or not, who knows? But you couldn't moot that point. So yes, I do think that we to a lesser or greater degree probably collude in our different aspects of life with the culture around us to just play by the rules of the game. I don't know if that sounds familiar or not to some of you. I've been struck, though. I wanted to tell you a story. It's a sort of modern-day parable, and it's a story of a good man going very, very astray. Have you heard of Donald Crowhurst? You heard of Donald Crowhurst? He was a man in the 60s, living in Somerset. And in 1968, you may have to correct me if I've got this wrong, in 1968, he was running a business in some town in Somerset, and it was heading for bankruptcy. And one of the main products that they produced was for boats, for sailing boats, and some electronic equipment for sailing boats. And he knew that the business was potentially on the rocks and heading for bankruptcy. He had a wife and a family and was obviously very, very concerned. Shortly before 1968, somebody whose name I forget had single-handedly sailed around the world, circumnavigated the world on his own. And I think the Times newspaper had caught hold of that and were running a competition for solo circumnavigation, people who would sail around the world. And Donald Crowhurst was a sailor in his part-time, spare time. That was his recreation, his hobby, his release from the pressures of his life. And he suddenly thought, well, maybe I should participate in this competition. What will happen is that I can get lots of sponsors to sponsor me for this competition, and maybe that will generate enough publicity to attract, you know, more interest, and maybe that will somehow save my business. There was a £5,000 prize if you were the fastest to circumnavigate the world. He didn't expect to win the prize, but he thought the sponsorship deals and the publicity might pull him out of this bankruptcy situation. So he enters, he puts his name down for the race. Now, the race was a race where you didn't all have to race together. You could start at any point you liked, any time you liked. The point was that you circumnavigated the globe. There was a sort of route. You could do it in your own time. And the winner was the person who completed the circumnavigation in the fastest time. But there was a deadline by which you needed to have started. And he was running late. He was running really, really late. So he decides to do this in a rush. He gets a boat. He buys a boat. Does it up as best he can. Come on in. Do come on in and get yourself some cushions if you need mats and cushions. He buys this boat. I'm just telling a story. You'll catch up. He buys this boat and gets all these sponsorship deals to do it up. In fact, all of it's paid for by sponsors. I think he calls it the Tynemouth Electron, because he was going to set sail from Tynemouth, and Electron was part of the name of his business. And he gets all these supplies. He's in a bit of a rush at the end of it all, getting this boat seaworthy and getting all the supplies together. Anyway, he finally sets off in October 1968. And unfortunately, the boat wasn't that sound. And various bits of electronic equipment weren't working. Anyway, he manages to sort of get to Africa. And he's sailing down, he's sailing south down the coast of Africa. He's meant to go round, you know, the Cape of Good Hope and onto, well, right down to Australia and then round again. And he's somewhere sailing down the coast of Africa, and he gets caught in a storm, and the boat starts leaking, and there's quite a lot of damage and wreckage. And the storm eventually subsides, and he's sort of just now left on the coast of Africa, still in the water, still in the boat, not quite knowing what he should do now. And one option is maybe he just patches the boat up and comes back home. The boat isn't going to do it. It's not going to really make this journey. So one option is that he just patches it up and comes back home. He feels embarrassed at doing that. All these people, all this publicity, his sponsorships, etc., this big fanfare that he'd had when he set off, he feels embarrassed. So he's decides to just take it easy and float around a bit, drift around, lying low. And as he's doing that, he's been keeping a log of his progress. And he's got nothing else to do. He's on his own, in the water. And he starts keeping a sort of fictional log at the same time as the real log. So he starts another log, and in this fictional, sort of imaginary log, imaginative log, he starts to record his progress as it would be if he were sailing around the world, and what he'd encountered, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Keeping this little kind of journal, maybe it was just a kind of writing exercise, etc. But suddenly, after a while, it dawns on him that maybe this log could prove useful, because nobody's actually going to know whether he has circumnavigated the globe or not. So what he could do is just keep a really good log, lie low in waters where he's not likely to be spotted by any shipping traffic, and then at an appropriate time, after some months, sort of sail back in, you know, from the west, looking as if he's come in from across the Atlantic. And anyway, this starts to sort of just germinate in his mind. he's not sure, but the log takes on a life of its own. This fictitious log starts to take on a life of its own. Eventually, he pulls into some sort of small town, some small port, and patches up his boat, so he's now able to at least, you know, go on to the open ocean. But now he's slightly worried that, oh, he's already broken the rules of this race, because he wasn't meant to have any assistance, and he's had some assistance in this town. So now he's even more compromised, do you know what I mean? There's no way that he can do this circumnavigation and claim that he's done it. He's either got to head off for home and say, sorry, I didn't do it, or he can just try and do this fictitious thing. And, of course, you can guess, he starts just thinking that he'll do the fictitious thing. There's a snag, which is that when all the sailors get to Australia, they're meant to radio in around Sydney and say they've got to Australia, they've got halfway round. Now, he's not going to be able to radio in from Australia, because he's not going to be in Australia. So what he decides to do is radio in now and say he's having generator problems, because if his generator packs up, then he'd be out of communication. So he radios in, says he's having generator problems, he might be out of communication for some time. So then he's sorted that one out, and then he just drifts around for weeks and weeks and weeks. He's just drifting around, in lying low, avoiding the shipping lanes. I think after 11 or 12 weeks, he decides to get in touch with his agent back home, who's been worried sick, as is his family, his wife, his children. He gets in touch and reports in that he's doing well. You know, he's doing all right, actually. And, this is his position, and he's making reasonable time. Now, to his horror, his agent, who's been really worried, has also been making up stories, because he hasn't had any communication, to say how well it's all going. Yeah, so there's all this publicity gathering around how well it's all going. And to his horror, what he's finding is that in the race, most of the sailors have dropped out. And he's now joint second in this race. Now, there's this person who's in the lead, who's a Frenchman. I can't remember his name. Now, the Frenchman is a bit of a mystic sailor. And he's not really interested in the race or winning. He's sailing for the sheer adventure and love of it. He seems to be doing rather well and is in the lead. And then there's this ex-Navy officer who's doing about as well as Donald. And then there's some other naval officer who's coming in third. And Donald is suddenly really worried, because he doesn't want that much publicity. He doesn't want to come in second. Coming in second, he'd have to get a lot of attention. People would need to then know what his log was, they'd look at his evidence, etc. He doesn't want to do that. So he decides to just take a little bit longer so that he'll fall behind the other people. Yeah, he takes longer and longer. Meanwhile, the person who's coming second, joint second with Donald, hears about this. He's been trying really hard. This next ex-naval officer has been trying really, really hard. And he realises that he's now joint second with Donald. Donald has suddenly turned up. He thought he was second, and now he's joint second, because Donald's suddenly turned up. So he really, really pushes himself, more so than he would have done otherwise. He gets caught in a storm, and rather than just taking a safe option, he tries to battle through this storm, because he's desperate to either at least come second or win. And his boat collapses in the storm. And fortunately, he's rescued, but his boat is just complete collapsed. and he's out of the race. So now Donald is definitely second. The Frenchman who's doing really well, the Frenchman decides that he's not interested in winning. He really likes being on the open ocean on his own, and he decides that instead of coming home, he's just going to carry on sailing. He's going to carry on sailing and do it all again, circumnavigate again. So he just sails out of the race. He sails out of the race, and Donald is suddenly in the winning lead. He's in the lead. He's completely horrified at this prospect that he'll have to come in. As well as the prize money and all the publicity, I think he has to go to, I don't know, to Parliament or something and meet some sort of dignitary who's an ex, you know, sailor, and talk about how they've circumnavigated the world together. And of course, he's completely horrified. And he's in a complete quandary. What does he do now? What does he do? Does he come clean? Does he not? And what he does is, well, he radios in, I think for the last time, and then he disappears. And the port authorities, the sailing authorities, eventually they find his boat, and they find it with these two logs, the real log and this fictitious log, and Donald has gone. And he decided to end it all. He couldn't face the prospect of, well, any of the prospects. He would have had to either carry on living the lie, or he would have had to come clean. Neither of those could he face doing. And he takes his own life. And the interesting thing is that he doesn't destroy the fictitious log. It's almost like a confession. At the very end, there's something in him, I think, that wanted the truth and wanted to tell the truth. He couldn't do it while he was alive, so he leaves the log, the fictitious log, as well as the real log, for the truth to be pieced together by whoever finds him. So a horrible kind of story, sort of captivating parable. Just want to pause there and see if you've got any. Buddhism has quite a lot to say on what got him into that sort of scenario where he found himself having no choice. And I just want to pause there and see if you can sort of draw out any of the sort of conditions, internal conditions, in Donald Crowhurst's mind that led him to that point. What do you think were some of the factors that were going on for him? Yeah.
He was very attached to his own identity.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't want to lose that.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a really strong attachment to his identity. I'll come to you. A really strong sense of his reputation. The damage to his reputation if he's seen to have fabricated the whole thing. Yeah. I saw a hand over there, and then I'll come to you. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just saying.
Sorry, there was just somebody behind you. I'll come to you later.
Kind of financial insecurity and fear of financial insecurity, yeah, in the first place that led him to.
Yeah, there was. There was fear of financial insecurity. And he was probably that was playing on his mind throughout as well, because the sponsorships were potentially going to save his business. And having attracted sponsorships and publicity, if he hadn't completed the race, or if he'd come clean about lying, he'd have lots of debtors wanting that money back. And then there was bankruptcy on the cards. Yeah, so there's worry, fear. There was a lot of fear going on. Yes. Yes, and then I'll come to you. Yeah.
One
wanting to meet expectations of others. I think that's right. Can you say in particular what sort of expectations he might have been concerned about?
Maybe it's probably expectations that he would have internalised, where he's sort of the person that he thinks that he should be.
Yes.
Of a certain status, having certain financial assets.
Yeah.
He feels that he's falling short of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, maybe of his family, maybe of his friends, maybe of
society as well.
In society. It's a small town that he lived in. People would have known each other, everybody would have known each other. And I think that's really probably a very key motivation. How much our reputation, as the other gentleman was saying, and our sense of wanting to meet other people's expectations, how much that can govern our behaviour. It's a very, very strong... Sorry, I'll come back to you. There's just somebody waiting. It's a very, very strong kind of motivation for our actions, isn't it? And often, we don't even know we're doing it, but we just want to conform to the world around us and its expectations of us. I can feel that as a familiar kind of motivation. Sorry, sir, I'll come back to you. Go on. No, well, go on, say...
themselves by the group around them.
Yes.
Nothing.
Yes.
Without their saying who they are.
Exactly.
You need to know who you are at some point.
Yeah.
He hadn't done that.
Yeah. How much of our... I think that's exactly right. How much of our sense of self seems to come from how other people relate to us? It's really strong, isn't it? It's really, really strong. One of the quests in Buddhism is to become more and more of an individual, somebody who can be themselves in a sort of teenagerish kind of rebellious way, but be themselves as a responsible person around, you know, take responsibility for their own actions, be considerate and aware of others, but not be dependent upon others for their own sense of self-worth. If our sense of self-worth is based on the group around us, the people around us, it's a very precarious position to be in, really, really precarious position to be in, if that's where our identity comes from. And somebody like Donald Prohurst, I think you're right, he was probably caught in that trap. The gentleman in the blue, you had something earlier.
Yeah, it's really been covered, but it's, the word that comes to mind is pride.
Pride, yeah.
I think it was probably a combination of things.
I think it's probably a combination of things, and I think pride, how we look in the eyes of others, etc., must have been one of the factors at play. In Buddhism, you've got this set of forces that are called the worldly winds. They're called the worldly winds. There's eight of those worldly winds, and it's said that if we're not very secure in ourselves, we'll be blown around by these worldly winds. And these worldly winds are pleasure and pain, fame and infamy, or fame and sort of notoriety, praise and blame, and loss and gain. So pleasure and pain, fame and infamy, praise and blame, and loss and gain. And how those forces operate in our lives, they are like winds blowing us around in our lives. And very often what we're doing is always trying to get the pleasure, the fame, the gain, and the praise. Yeah, we're always sort of tacking, if we're in a boat, towards what will give us those things, avoiding as best we can the opposites. But that's a very, very insecure way of living our lives, really insecure way of living our lives, if our values, if our life values are basically chasing after praise, fame, gain, whatever the fourth one was, pleasure. It's quite a narrow course to try and traverse. Yeah. So there's something, isn't there, about how do we become more able to be an individual, a real individual who's able to just have a real sense of self-worth, to be able to be yourself, to tell the truth about who you are, without fearing blame and loss of fame and loss generally, and even pain. So any thoughts about what how you might do that? How do we do that? In a way, it's about growing up, isn't it? But how do we grow up in that way? Because so many adults don't manage to.
Sometimes coming clean can win more respect and praise from people who would say, yes, I can find myself in that situation and I respect the person for coming clean.
Yes. Yes, I think so. Sometimes that's true, but it's probably not without pain, that coming clean. You're going to... it might end in, yes, some people respecting you. Along the way, there's going to be pain, maybe loss of face, maybe I don't know, a loss of friends even, or loss of a certain respect, identity, all sorts of things. Yeah, it's interesting what David Foster Wallace said in one of his books, Infinite Jest. He said, "The truth will set you free, but not until it's finished with you." The truth will set you free, but not until it's finished with you. So in a way, it's not necessarily an easy path to tell the truth. C.S. Lewis, I found something else C.S. Lewis said. He said, if you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth. Only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin, and in the end, despair. That's interesting, isn't it? If you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth. Only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin, and in the end, despair. Which is, in a way, what happened to Donald Crowhurst. In the end, there was just despair. There was wishful thinking in the beginning, and in the end, despair. Yeah. So I think there is something about learning to be strong enough to face the consequences of our actions, to tell the truth. There is something about learning to trust that the consequences are worth facing, and that in the end that's going to lead to more freedom, even if there's pain along the way. For me also, meditation has been crucial. One of the effects of meditation is that you start to see what's really going on in your mind. And often, what's going on in our mind at a deeper level isn't the same as what's going on at a conscious level. Often, we're being driven by urges, voices, volitions, emotions that are just beneath the radar of consciousness, and yet they act as forces governing our lives and governing our behaviours. One of the things about meditation is that it starts to reveal more of our mind to our conscious selves. It reveals our impulses, our motivations, what's really driving us. And sometimes what is revealed isn't very pretty. In fact, it seldom is completely kind of lovely. Sometimes it's actually quite difficult to be honest with ourselves. But unless we can start to be honest with ourselves as to what's really happening, what happens is that we end up... become even more fragmented, sort of psychically split. Somebody like Donald Crowhurst, at the end, I suspect, he was psychically really split. somewhere in the middle, he probably started to believe his own lies. And what happened was that there's a bit of him that believes his own lies, the bit of him that believes he really ought to come clean. There's a bit of him that believes, no, it's just a white lie and it won't really matter. And it tears you apart. Those different volitions internally tear you apart. Every time we ignore an aspect of what's happening for us, we're potentially splitting off from it in an unhelpful way, in a really unhelpful way. One of the things meditation does is it starts to create a more integrated psyche where we really know ourselves more. The light and the dark of our experience is conscious. And only on that basis can we start making really conscious choices. Only on that basis can we start being really truthful. Otherwise, we don't really know what we think or what we feel. I mean, I'm maybe exaggerating that, but nevertheless, it's true of a lot of us a lot of the time. A sort of example, I don't know if you've sometimes met people who they seem to be really friendly and nice, and you meet them and you think you're quite an angry person. Have you had that experience? That underneath their friendly behaviour, what you sense is aggression. It's a sort of, yes, passive aggression, possibly. Often, a person like that isn't aware of their own aggression. They really do think they're being friendly. Before I started to meditate, I thought I was quite a nice man. And then I was taught this meditation about developing kindness. One of the meditations we teach here is about developing kindness. And as I started to do this meditation, I realized that I wasn't such a nice man, after all. As I started to really see the thoughts and volitions in my mind, there was quite a lot of anger and aggression and hatred and unkindness and resentment and da-da-da. I mean, not huge amounts, actually. I was still basically nice. But there was more than I thought. And that's not an unusual experience to start to discover aspects of yourself that weren't conscious to yourself. Yeah.
Could I just raise one more thing?
Which is, yes.
Sometimes people might think that there is a larger truth.
Yes.
Behind the lie.
Yes, they might do.
And I think that happens quite a lot.
Yes.
So I'm just doing this little lie, but it gets us to somewhere else where there's a bigger truth or a greater justice.
Yes. The end justifying the means.
Mm.
Can you think of anything particular?
Well, I think research form is one in science.
Yeah.
People think that, if I just do this research, this little experiment falsely,
right,
we get to where we need to get because we need to get the money,
yes,
and we need to build the platform, and then we get the answer.
Yes.
And politics as well, I think.
Yes. I live with a scientist, a neuroscientist, and I've been rather shocked at some of the stories that he's come home with about how people do slightly massage the results to get the evidence that they need to make the case that they want, etc., etc.
What would Buddhism say about that? If there is that larger truth?
Buddhism wouldn't say that the end would justify the means. Yes, there might be some sort of larger goal that one's aiming for, but to fudge things in order to get there wouldn't be advocated at all by Buddhism. No.
So it wouldn't support relative morality.
Well, what Buddhism would say is that we have to distinguish between conventional morality, maybe, and a natural morality. So it depends what you mean by relative morality. What would you say?
Say we would have to kill 10 people to save 100 people.
Mm, yeah.
And we have to make a choice that these people are the cause of our problems.
I see, yeah.
Mistakes.
Yeah.
So in Find out later they're the wrong
10. They're the wrong 10 or something. Buddhism wouldn't support that. It wouldn't support that. But nor would then Buddhism give you easy answers as to what do you do. Yeah? In that sort of scenario, what Buddhism would say is, look, if you act from hatred, then that will lead to unhelpful, painful consequences. If you act from greed, it's going to be the same. If you act from delusion, covering up the truth, it's going to lead to the same. But it doesn't give you easy answers as to what do you do in that sort of moral dilemma. What it says is, look, try and develop as much awareness and kindness and generosity of spirit and open-heartedness and empathy as you can in your life. Try and develop that more and more. Then when life presents you with a dilemma, well, you'll have to work it out. But try and do that then from the basis of that open-heartedness, that empathy, that love, that generosity, and be aware of the dangers of self-centeredness creeping in. Yeah? Be honest about mixed motives. There's another though, I'm going to have to end soon, there's another aspect to, well, what Buddhism says is going on, which is that actually we're never really aware of the truth. This bigger truth that you, sir, were talking about, there's an even sort of bigger truth that Buddhism points to. And in what Buddhism says is that all of us who are unenlightened, I'm not enlightened, all of us who are unenlightened are sort of living a delusion. We're all of us living, as it were, a lie. We don't necessarily know it, but we're all living a delusion about what's going on. And the reason that we're fundamentally deluded is that Buddhism says if you really look, there isn't this separate me in here that's guiding everything, separate from the world out there. Our basic assumption is that there's a real separate me. In my case, it's called Jnanavacha. And there's a real world out there. And from my perspective, you're all part of that real world out there. And I'm part of this real me in here. And for you, it's the other way around. And Buddhism's saying, actually, there's something more mysterious going on. If you look at experience, you can't simplify it in those terms. When you have any experience, when you see something, when you hear something, taste something, any of the sense experiences, all of that experience is happening within your mind. It's happening somewhere in your mind. It's not necessarily how the world is. It's a mind-made experience. Psychologists, you know, working on the nature of perception, scientists working on the nature of perception, they'd say that the brain creates our world. Buddhism would say that, well, the brain's involved, but even consciousness, even the brain can't explain this phenomena of being conscious. That consciousness is something more mysterious than matter. So from that perspective, something very weird is going on all the time. What is happening every time you have a thought or every time you see something? What's really going on? What's really out there and what's in here? And in a way, what's in here, what does that mean anyway? Who am I? Who am I if I remove all the labels and the stories? Who am I? And Buddhism says, well, it's much more mysterious. It doesn't reduce things to, like, there's a soul, an essential soul in me. And it doesn't say that the world doesn't exist out there. It's saying something much, much more mysterious. There's a larger reality going on that we're not aware of at all. So when we talk about the truth in Buddhism, it shades into what the Buddha taught about his enlightened experience. He was talking about a way of seeing, a way of perceiving things that saw the truth of a situation. And it wasn't like we perceive things at all. So maybe I'll just take one question and then we'll have to start winding up. Yes?
Coming back to the story from the boat, do you think
yes.
it was very innate human behaviour? Do you think a lot of us in that situation were acting the same way, or was it more of us?
I think there's a lot of... for me, when I read that story, I can sympathise with a lot of that behaviour. When you take into account some of the things that we were talking about, the fear, the pressure he was under in terms of his business going down, when you start off telling just a little lie and then it's a bit too difficult to go back, and it seems like an innocent lie that then takes on a bigger proportion, it's very understandable. One of the things about that story is that each little act that he did was very understandable, sort of forgivable, as it were. He couldn't see the whole picture of what the consequences were, and then when he did, it was too late. And the other thing was that he wasn't really in control. Now, none of us are in control in life. It wasn't his fault that the Frenchman decided to pull out of the race and go around the world again. It wasn't his fault that the other person who was coming second got caught in a storm and shipwrecked, etc. He wasn't in control, and none of us are. But when we start lying to manipulate the world, we lose any sense of integrity of action that we might otherwise have. In a way, although we're not in control, one of the freedoms that we do have is to know what we think and feel and to be honest about that. That's perhaps one of the only freedoms that we have. We then can't necessarily control how other people are going to respond. But we can start to just be honest about ourselves. If we give up that freedom, we just become slaves to the world around us. And that, to me, feels like a trap every time we compromise in order to get the praise or the favour or the fame or whatever. Every time we do that, we lose a little bit more freedom. And then we can end up living a lie. Although Donald Crowhurst's story is extreme in its tragedy, I think a lot of the time, a lot of us live a less dramatic lie when we conform to what other people want around us and the world around us. The world around us is telling us all the time, you will be happy if you have the perfect house, the career, the car, the holiday, the partner. And in a certain sense, that's a lie that we're being sold. And every time we buy into that, we're lying. Think about when you've said to somebody, you know, they ask you whether you love them. And you say, yes, I love you. And it's sometimes the easiest thing to say. Is it the truth? Are we trying to just live a lie? So it's quite sobering when we start thinking about what would it mean to not compromise on the truth. What would the consequences for our life be? Okay, maybe we should leave it there on that sobering note and hopefully see you again at some point. Thank you very much.